Almighty God, Lord of all life, we praise you for the advancements in computerized communications that we enjoy in our time.
It's June 14th, 1995. The Senate is preparing for a pivotal vote, and the Senate chaplain delivers a prayer unlike anything heard before in the chamber.
Sadly, however, there are those who are littering the information superhighway with obscene, indecent, and destructive pornography.
His prayer will set the stage for a heated battle over the future of the internet.
Now, guide the senators as they consider ways of controlling the pollution of computer communications and how to preserve one of our greatest resources, the minds of our children, and the future moral strength of our nation. Amen.
The Senate was about to hear arguments over the first attempt to regulate pornography online. Leading the charge, Nebraska Senator James Exon.
Mr. President, I have here and have had the opportunity to share with several members of the Senate on both sides of the aisle what I refer to as the Blue Book.
The 75-year-old raises a fat blue binder. On its cover in red is a message, warning, do not open until further instructions, offensive material enclosed, keep out of the reach of children.
When I have shown this to members on both sides of the aisle, there has been shock. Shock because few understand what is going on today with regard to the pollution of the internet.
Years later, Senator Exon will admit that he had never actually used the internet before this session. But that doesn't stop him from brandishing his binder of disturbing images, a prop that is both alarming and effective.
I am sure that my colleagues and their staffs, whether they agree completely with this senator or not, they can't help but be concerned about this very real threat that is out there today from all of this sex sickness that is rampant on the internet today.
It's a powerful moment, and if Senator Exon had had his way in 1995, this bill could have cut the internet off at its knees. But there is a silver lining here. Section 230. I'm Mike Masnick. This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet. In this episode, we'll dive into one of the biggest controversies of the early internet and a battle that could have changed everything.
Every day that goes by that children have access to sexually explicit material, more and more children are being harmed.
Two lawmakers fight to keep the internet free and flourishing.
Just look to me like mass censorship.
There needed to be a way to deal with these problems that didn't ruin the entire internet.
We ended last episode with a court ruling that rattled the internet industry. A popular message board platform called Prodigy lost a high-stakes lawsuit against the Wolf of Wall Street.
It's a pretty crazy opinion. The moment that a platform takes any steps at all to moderate content, it becomes liable for everything.
Two congressmen recognized the problems with this ruling. Chris Cox and Ron Wyden sprang into action with an idea that would become Section 230.
We hear our voters always talking about personal responsibility. Let's apply that to content.
If someone posts on a site, that person bears the responsibility for what that person says.
And they discovered the solution to the internet's moderation debate.
It's literally called the Good Samaritan Statute. So it's all about not creating liability for failing to take things down.
So with those parameters, you know, the law began to take shape.
But they weren't the first people on the Hill with proposals for regulating the internet.
Something that is sweeping this country, and that is pornography directed at children primarily, on the information superhighway, generally called the internet.
Senator Exon's bill would become the Communications Decency Act, or CDA. Senator Ron Wyden actually witnessed the Blue Book himself when he was still a representative.
Exon was a conservative, Democrat. And by the time we really found our footing, he was already off to the races and walking around the Senate cloakroom showing people pictures of horrible things on the internet. I'm not kidding. I saw it when I got to the Senate.
Senate had been the first mover here.
Former Congressman Chris Cox.
And not because they were reacting to the Prodigy CompuServe lawsuits, but rather because they were legislating against pornography on the internet.
Exxon wasn't alone in his crusade against online pornography. He enlisted allies like Republican Dan Coats.
There is a dark side to the internet, and that dark side brings unrestricted pornographic material into every home.
And it wasn't just lawmakers sounding the alarm. Many parents were understandably worried about their kids going online and stumbling onto inappropriate content.
Innocent children searching for help with their homework or simply looking to learn more about the world can be confronted with the most deviant and pervasive images. For example, a search for working men pulls up men working together without any clothes.
Family values groups like the Family Research Council and the Christian Coalition rallied on Capitol Hill, urging lawmakers to pass the CDA.
Thank you.
The loudest of all the groups was Enough is Enough. They were the ones to show Senator Exxon those disturbing photos that inspired his blue book.
The government needs the legal tool to prosecute a pedophile who knowingly sends Penthouse magazine to a child.
A cover story in Time magazine helped stoke the fires. The headline, Cyberporn. And the front page showed a young boy, eyes wide open, bathed in his computer's blue light, and gaping in horror at what one assumes is porn.
Inside that box of circuit boards and silicon chips thrives a whole secret world of virtual sexuality.
It's certainly not hard to find.
Dad, get a load of this.
The Time story focused on a study that claimed that more than 83% of the images stored on Usenet newsgroups were porn. It turns out that wasn't exactly true. The paper was written by an undergrad student, and it mostly used data from private bulletin boards that sold porn to adults and required a credit card, so kids weren't exactly stumbling across all this smut.
So you had some studies that weren't very methodologically sound, and you had these news magazine cover stories that really were sensational. So it was a problem that wasn't going away.
That's Jeff Kossoff, the cyber law expert and author of the book, The 26 Words That Created the Internet.
And Senator Exxon, he really relied on a lot of scare tactics to convince his colleagues in the Senate, who tend to be a bit older and not as fluent in technology, that this is a real problem and the way to deal with this is criminal liability.
His bill, his proposal, would ban from the internet anything that was unsuitable for minors. Now, that was obviously a wholesale protection for minors, no question, but it also would have meant that the entire internet would have been dumbed down to the level of what underage people should be allowed to see.
The bill made it so the FCC could criminally charge anyone who posted content that the government deemed inappropriate for kids.
They just had no idea, or at least Senator Exxon had no idea, of how much content they were talking about and the fact that it was real time. Casting his dragnet as wide as he did and having, you know, criminal enforcement and only things suitable for minors on the web, you know, all of this was a vision that was very dark from our standpoint.
Both of us had heard about Senator Exxon talking about some gigantic decency act. I didn't know everything about it, but it just looked to me like mass censorship.
But Ron Wyden had actually seen Senator Exxon's blue book, so he understood the basis for concern.
I was a parent of young kids, and I just thought to myself, what is the key here? And the key would be to come up with things that empowered parents to figure out a way to protect their kids rather than to get in the business of Mr. Exxon's censorship.
We understood also that there needed to be a way to deal with these problems that didn't ruin the entire internet. And that way, as we saw it, was giving the users of the internet the greatest latitude in controlling what came across their own portal. And so that was our idea.
Their idea became the Internet Freedom and Family Empowerment Act, the precursor to Section 230. Chris Cox and Ron Wyden thought their personal responsibility approach could be a solution for concerned parents, one that would also protect free speech. They were tech-savvy enough to know that there were already tools like NetNanny that allowed parents to control their kids' experience online. Instead of involving the FCC or paring the internet down to just what was appropriate for minors, Cox and Wyden's bill gave parents, not the government, the power to decide what their kids could see. And so, the two congressmen hit the Hill to rally support.
Chris and I were kind of people who cared about policy, and we were looking at all these court decisions that made no sense at all, and Exxon that made no sense at all, and we set out to do something about it.
Ron Wyden and Chris Cox had a simple game plan to get their bill passed: divide and conquer. It helped that they were from opposite parties.
Chris, and he was such a good partner, immediately made a beeline for people like Newt Gingrich and conservatives, and I think because of his credibility and his smarts, and he's a Harvard lawyer and the like, he immediately got some traction over there. I made a beeline for progressives and ACLU folks.
There's a whole lot of conversation. We're socializing this with various members, talking to them in their offices. What do you think? How do you approach this? What are the upsides and downsides and so on? And during that vetting process, you know, a lot of things started to come into focus. But importantly, there was a coalescence of viewpoint.
And eventually we started having meetings. We got everybody together. We were assembling pretty regularly. And we found that there was a lot of common ground.
People could see that treating the internet as if it were a place only for minors was not a suitable approach.
As we picked up some momentum, I was surprised how well we were doing. It was so new back then. Chris and I have laughed a little bit about it. Is most people didn't know enough to give us a hard time. Now, there was a block of people who were really the traditional censor crowd and, you know, pornography and all this kind of thing. And we kept saying, you know, this is different. This is not your usual kind of classic debate, and this is the digital world.
The pro-censorship crowd pushed for old fixes, like a movie rating system for online content. But Chris and Ron helped them grasp the sheer scale of the internet. Pre-screening everything through the government just wasn't realistic. So a lot of folks changed their tune.
I mean, it was an unusual thing when we brought the bill to the floor that the time was divided up not as usual between opponents and supporters, but rather between supporters on the Democratic and Republican side that controlled the time. And no one, you know, I've read through the congressional record many times over the last few decades, literally no one spoke against it. And that's not because there isn't an argument to be made, but because the people who were speaking for it handled those arguments in their presentations and said, you know, this is the better approach.
Remember, Senator Exxon's Communications Decency Act had already passed the Senate. But now, the House had passed the Cox-Wyden bill, a law that directly opposed Exxon's CDA.
And because the Senate had voted first, even though they later saw that the House of Representatives was nearly unanimous in going the other way, they had all these people on record, one-third of them up for election that year, having voted for it. So in the House-Senate conference, it would be kind of embarrassing for them to walk it back. And they did what the conferees did, what you know, the House and Senate often do in these situations. They log-rolled and they said, okay, we'll put them both in.
So instead of choosing between the two conflicting bills, they folded Section 230 into Exxon CDA, ensuring that both would make it into the final bill.
So it was very much just cobbled together, and they ended up in the same title within the Telecommunications Act.
Section 230 historian Jeff Kossoff.
That's why when you hear people say Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, Section 230 was never proposed as the Communications Decency Act. And in fact, it was proposed as the alternative to the Communications Decency Act.
Chris and I had no idea where this was going to go, but we thought that it was going to make a difference and it was going to be good for freedom and good for innovation and good for this new thing that everybody was just getting their arms around. The prospect that the two of us would be even thinking about having the chutzpah as not senior people. We weren't leadership, you know, people, and basically came up with one of the developments and the 26 words that created the internet ought to be a message to everybody to dream big.
The signing ceremony for the Telecommunications Act was actually at the Library of Congress. This is not very usual. The Library of Congress is a glorious building.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President and the Vice President of the United States.
And here, in the midst of all this grandeur, is President Clinton, and here is the Vice President. It was an opportunity for them to talk about the information highway, as it was then called, and all of this wonderful change and opportunity that would result.
This law is truly revolutionary legislation that will bring the future to our doorstep.
This was the first wholesale modernization of the rules governing modern technology in the communications space. It's all televised, so it was a big deal. And I was very happy that we got so much attention.
There were hundreds of competing visions for how to develop the legislation that we celebrate today. But to honor our responsibility as public servants, we had to look beyond immediate self-interest to the properties of the system as a whole.
Al Gore didn't invent the internet, but he was one of its biggest champions, and he helped shape the Telecommunications Act. For the signing ceremony, he even enlisted Lily Tomlin to play her SNL character, Ernestine the Phone Operator, to demonstrate a live internet video call, something few had witnessed before.
1 gigabitty? 2 gigabitties? Have I reached the party to whom I am speaking?
Yes. Thank you, Ernestine. Would you please help the president and me place a call to some young people from Calvin Coolidge High School, please?
Who is this?
It's me, Ernestine, Al Gore.
Oh, Mr. Veep. Surfing the net. Downloading images of global climate change again? You crazy guy.
You know, you have to step back in time to remember that long-distance telephony was really expensive. Now that we have phones in our pockets and can call anyone in the world almost, you know, it's hard to believe that we didn't have that kind of instantaneous global communication.
We're going to sign a copy of the bill over here and send it into cyberspace. I believe that this is the first bill that ever made that journey. Again, let me thank you from the bottom of my heart, every one of you, for making this great day for America possible. Thank you.
President Clinton signed the Telecom Act with the same pen Eisenhower used to sign the Interstate Highway Act in 1957.
The Interstate Highway Act literally brought Americans closer together. And that same spirit of connection and communication is the driving force behind the Telecommunications Act of 1996.
Within that new law, Ron Wyden and Chris Cox's rules of the road for the internet.
And so simultaneous with modernizing the telecommunications laws in general, we have Section 230 that makes it possible for the internet to function freely.
So Section 230 became law. Internet users were now fully responsible for the content they posted, reflecting the public's preference for personal responsibility. Platforms like Prodigy, CompuServe, and AOL were all given the same protections. They could moderate content without having to fear a flood of lawsuits if something slipped through the cracks. Now, they had an incentive to clean those message boards of spam and objectionable content. The foundation of the internet was officially set. But even with all that fanfare at the Library of Congress, hardly anyone even noticed that Section 230 had passed.
This was such a side note to what they were really focused on, which was when can you let the baby bells compete for long distance service, which it's crazy now, but that was the big economic issue at the time.
Back in 1996, the headlines were all about how the act opened up competition between the big national telephone companies and the regional spinoffs, which were called baby bells.
And the internet was kind of this little sideshow that they kind of had to deal with something because there were parents groups that were upset about it. But it wasn't a big economic issue because at the time you weren't dealing with Google's and Facebook's, you were dealing with Prodigy and CompuServe, which were decent-sized companies, but they were not among the largest companies in the U.S. economy at the time. So I frankly just don't think that many people gave it much thought.
Part of the genius of Section 230 was that it sort of flew under the radar.
Tech policy expert Jessica Malugin.
You know, it's a piece of legislation inside another piece of legislation inside another piece of legislation. I think also because Section 230 was bipartisan, and these were two kind of, you know, really well-respected, straight shooter, like these are serious, thoughtful, sincere public servants. The way it got done with kind of very little fanfare focused on what would turn out to be such a consequential and these days a bit more controversial of a law is like one of, it's just a great Washington story, right? But if you would look back and turn on your evening news in 1996, I don't know you'd hear too much about it.
Maybe it's just professional pride, but Chris Cox disagrees.
You know, that's, I think, a bit of revisionist history. Time magazine said at one point, you know, the balance between protecting speech and curbing pornography seemed to be tipping back toward the libertarians. They noted that I and Wyden were putting together an anti-Exxon amendment that would bar federal regulation of the internet and help parents find ways to block material they found objectionable. This is getting national coverage. So it wasn't just that it was, you know, not flying under the radar in Congress. It was not flying under the radar in the country.
I plead guilty to think it's a kick in the pants to go back with Masnick a little bit on the history of this stuff, because there aren't very many people. I got to tell you, Mike, you'll like this. A lot of people, you know, that we worked with back then, unfortunately, have passed from the earth. I was doing all this checking and fact-checking, and my wife said, dear, you know, a lot of these people aren't even alive anymore. And she basically looked at me and she said, can you guys say anything you want because you've outlived everybody? And I said, no. That's not the spirit of chutzpah and 230. We want to be people who have big ideas and have the freedom to talk about it, but there aren't many of us left, Mike, so let's enjoy it.
We'll forgive two veteran legislators for having their own view of history. But if Section 230 did go unnoticed, maybe it was because people were quickly realizing what the rest of the law was about to do to the internet.
It would have been, the worldwide Sesame Street, I guess.
We are talking about restrictions on speech that goes far beyond pornography.
The Communications Decency Act burns to the ground. And what's left? A new kind of internet.
That is what kind of gave a huge head start to the American platforms to grow.
We definitely had a very vibrant army of contributors, and we knew that we were protected from being sued for anything they posted.